Welcome to Death Watch, hosted by myself. My name is Matt Brown, and my friend here.
Oh, I'm Matthew Price, and that's the other host of our show.
The other host of Death Watch.
Death Watch.
Today, we're going to be looking at the career of editor Ann V. Coates, who died just this year. Very recent death for us to look at. Before we get into that, however, I want to do two things. One, I want to obviously thank our friends of the Modern Superior Network who host the show and provide a community for us to reach out to with this podcast. And I also want to officially put See You Next Wednesday on Death Watch.
Has it been a while?
It's slowed to a trickle. I'm alarmed as a fan of that program. I'm concerned.
I am. Let's focus on the positive.
Of course,
those three guys. It was three different people.
Yep.
That did that show in an unbroken run.
I know,
for
like five straight years.
For five straight years,
weekly.
And let's be clear, that is not their jobs.
No,
like
no,
not even close. Yeah. So yeah. This podcasting thing is fun, but if you're listening to podcasts, most of the certainly the good ones,
yep,
are by just regular Joes like us.
Yeah.
And you are somehow like disappointed that they didn't keep up their production schedule. Like it's very hard.
No, I know.
To do that, we've scaled this back to once a month for this show.
Yeah.
And that feels, that feels right.
It does.
That once
it's
a month feels
very
right.
There's nice.
The fact that like few weeks go by and I don't have to think about this show that much,
yep,
and then like can sort of go think about it again. Oh, that feels good.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
And we can put them on Death Watch,
no,
but I feel like, guys,
it's
you did amazing.
It's a teasing reference.
You're
at
doing
any
great,
time,
sweeties.
They have accomplished
you're doing
their,
great.
Yeah, they've accomplished their mission, and then some. And it's the rigorousness of the cadence that, again, I don't want to get too inside baseball on podcasting. If you've never made a podcast, if you just listen to them, God bless you. That's terrific. But
yeah,
you have no idea how skull-crushingly hard it is to turn out 2 hours of content once a week when it's not your job.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
If you ever want to disprove the thought that you've had to yourself that goes something like, boy, I love talking about things.
Yep.
If you've had that thought like, I love going to parties and yep, having conversations, take on a podcast. You will rid yourself of that notion.
Yep.
There will be a point at which you're like, oh, I'm all done.
Yeah, exactly. perhaps slightly more in Death Watch's line, I just want to once again mention, I'm going to get the name of the show wrong because I always do. I believe it is Fully and Completely. How do you feel about that?
I feel like it's
fully
probably
completely,
correct.
Something like that.
I think Fully Completely is the name of the album and Fully and Completely is the name of the
that
show.
That could very well be
the band.
Be it. Yeah. So anyway, yeah. Greg LeGrove of See You Next Wednesday and Jamie Dew of The Do-Over have
and,
this.
And A Show of Strength.
Yeah, and A Show of Strength. So
very
both
important.
Longtime pillars, if you will,
yes,
of the Modern Superior Network. They're doing this show about the Tragically Hip, which, as I think I said on Twitter the other day, essentially you should consider it a Death Watch show. Because it's going to be a long process of looking at the career of Gord Downie, along with the rest of the Tragically Hip,
yeah,
and very cool.
In a way that we could never
no
attempt on this show, and so, yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
And I also want to just quickly get a little plug in there, just back on Jamie Dew.
Yep.
For Father's Day, he was nice enough to have me on his, you want to talk about rigor, daily podcast.
This is Daily Grind?
Daily Grind.
Right.
He is trying to do a show sometimes more than once a day, which is pretty amazing. And we talked about anxiety and how living with anxiety has an effect on you as a parent.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Father's Day, that was the topic. And there's you'll learn more about me than you really wanted to.
How
I
much
think
more could there be in that tank?
You
and I
maybe
have taken
not. If you've been a longtime Mammo listener, I think probably not much. But I think for casual listeners of that show, they may be like,
yeah,
"Well, who is this guy and why is he oversharing?" You
know?
So there's a lot that we went. We just went into like the history of my history of
sure
anxiety and how
I did not know this. I'm glad you called this out. I'm going to go listen to that episode right after we record this. We're recording this, by the way, on June 20th. It will be dropping on our feed next Friday, which is the 29th of June.
Sure will.
So we apologize if the following information is in any way out of date. However, for June 20th, this is Roll Call.
Roll Call. This is Roll Call. Your monthly reminder of all the folks.
The futility of...
That we have lost. Out of the... I almost Googled this, and then I thought, I'm not going to bother. I'm going to make up a number. Roughly every month, over 100 billion people die.
Yeah.
And out of that number, this is who we thought was important.
That's right. Yep.
So we... And I just want to say, like, having done this now for several months in a row, there's always that week after we record when I'm like, man, is anybody going to die? Like,
well,
like, there's always a little lull there where we just, nothing happens.
It certainly feels that way for me. It's more, it is the lull immediately before we commit to the next month's subject.
Yes, yes.
And then as soon as we commit, four of the most people,
yes.
most important people in the history of pop
just
culture.
Four of the most people.
The most people. The largest people we were able to find, they just dropped dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we start the month with, at least for me, a big one, author Tom Wolfe.
Sure.
So let's take a minute before we keep going.
Is it a minute of silence? Because this is an audio show.
No, I don't want to take a minute of silence, but I do want to take a minute to talk about the enormous importance of Tom Wolfe.
Okay.
Who, among other things, you could argue that he co-created the nonfiction novel along with Truman Capote. So it's very close in terms of what you consider the first nonfiction novel. Some people consider it to be In Cold Blood. But Tom Wolfe was taking the idea of being a reporter and pushing it out to being an author in a way that very few people had. And when he did decide ultimately to go into full fiction, the results were spectacular because he still had this sort of very keen eye for verisimilitude in his writing. So it's certainly worth going back and reading Bonfire of the Vanities, which is his Dickensian take on, you know, late 80s junk bond greed culture, sort of like Wall Street. But it's even more worth it to go back and read something like From Bauhaus to Our House, which is about architecture, or The Right Stuff, which is about the beginnings of the space program. He is an enormous talent and a sort of a singular person, and it was just, that is a huge loss. So, and that is not even the biggest,
Jesus Christ, we had a month.
Is not even the biggest literary loss this month. So yeah, we'll get to that. But so that, Tom Wolfe kicked it off. We lost Jimmy Nickerson. Jimmy Nickerson did all the stunts for Rocky and Raging Bull.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow.
Wow. So he was the stand-in
for
De Niro and Stallone. That is something.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Joseph Campanella, the actor. Patricia Morrison, who was an actress who originated... she was a screen actress somewhat, but she also was the original lead in Kiss Me, Kate on Broadway. Movie poster designer Bill Gold.
Yeah.
Big.
Holy moly.
Boy,
when
it's,
people
when
started rolling out
the posters, like, that he did, and it was
it was everything.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, I know movie poster designers. There's that Drew guy, and there's Saul Bass, and those are the ones, right? And then you see this guy's stuff, and you're like, oh, no, this is the real deal. Holy cow.
Yep.
What, can you want to, I can't even call to mind, but you must, do you
have
any? The
one that just pops up in my mind right now, well, I mean, he did do Casablanca, so that's significant.
Yeah, he started, he's much more, that's the crazy part. He started, like, that's like the first thing he did was Casablanca. Yeah. It's like what the person we're going to talk about today, you know, her crowning achievement is like her third film as an editor.
I know.
Anyway,
Yeah, and I mean, I think, if I'm not mistaken, he did The Exorcist, which is the one where I was like, oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, like where you're like, man, alive, talk about a poster that pulls the whole movie into a single image.
Like just these iconic images.
Yeah, the portent of the figure looking up at the house in The Exorcist. You don't need to know a thing.
Right.
Right? It's Did he do The Shining?
Did he do
The
Shining?
I feel like he did The Shining. Anyway, he, you know, like, again, it was one of these guys where I was like, oh, my God, this is an enormous. No, it was Clockwork Orange.
That's right. Yeah.
That's the one where I was like, oh, forget it. You did this? Forget it. That's every dorm room ever in history.
Yeah, I know.
Right? Has that Clockwork Orange poster.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. All right, we'll come down a little bit.
Okay.
Actor Clint Walker, who was in The Dirty Dozen and the TV show Cheyenne. Now, this here is a significant person for me, and you may not know the name right away. Do you know who Robert Indiana is?
No.
Robert Indiana was a sculptor and artist, and he is the person who sculpted the Love sculpture.
Oh.
That is in Philadelphia.
Wow.
The letters L-O-V-E, probably the most iconic piece of public art of the 20th century, I would say. Mm-hmm. It's been replicated in many cities. Philadelphia, City of Brotherly Love, is where it was originated. We've been to and taken our picture with the original sculpture.
Indeed, because we have Brotherly Love.
We do. And boy, we love Philadelphia.
Yeah, great, great town.
It is. And then we come to the person that topped Tom Wolfe. So, Philip Roth.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's really in the top three. It's him and Saul Bellow and John Updike. And that's your 20th century, folks. That's the world of fiction.
Yeah, pretty much.
Three old, horny white men.
Very horny.
Very horny.
Yeesh.
Yeah. Well, my favorite, not about him, but my favorite description of John Updike is somebody once called him a penis with a thesaurus, which is the greatest.
Yeah, that's terrific.
So Philip Roth, who, you know, Portnoy's Complaint, and sort of brought this idea around sexuality neurosis to the forefront of American writing, and mm-hmm. but then went on to do monumental work. And unfortunately, one of those authors who is so hard to fully capture that there are no good films based on his work, really.
Yeah, true.
You know, they tried again with American Pastoral just recently, and it is a car wreck. Like, it's not good.
I mean, Ewan McGregor should maybe have not attempted that as his first feature as a director.
Maybe a mistake.
It's pretty complicated work.
You know, I'm glad you love a book, Ewan.
Yeah, and I mean,
like, that is the problem.
And he
could get the money, and he loves the book, right? Yeah. And it's like, but that's, you need to be, you want to do American Pastoral? You need to be Sidney Lumet.
Yeah, to
you
an
need
extent.
To you need to be Frankenheimer.
And
to
I
do
also
that, right?
always think it's a mistake for an actor to star in their first directing project. I always think it's better if they step back.
Yeah, it's incredibly hard. It's a double-edged sword because it's incredibly hard to get the money without starring in it.
Of course.
But it's equally hard to do it well.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think the only one I can think of, and not that he's such a good guy, but Kevin Spacey, I don't think he was in Albino Alligator.
No, and I was thinking also of Ben Affleck. Like, I think not that great of a guy, but I think his decision to not star in Gone Baby Gone, arguably still his best film.
Agree. Yeah. And it was the pressure of making him be in his own films that's kind of ruined his ability to be a director.
Yep.
Okay. So from there, sorry, just give me one second.
Sure.
So, because boy, it's a long list.
Mm-hmm.
This is a long
Telling
list
you,
of folks.
Rough month.
So this is maybe like not such a major figure, but I did find this really interesting. Richard Dick Goodwin, who was a speechwriter for, do you know where I'm going with this?
No.
He was a speechwriter, I believe, for Eisenhower, and he was and a playwright. But he's also the person that broke the scandal on that became the movie Quiz Show.
Oh,
he's the one that figured it out and wrote the book on I can't remember the name of the actual show in Quiz Show, but 20
that
questions
quiz
or
show.
Whatever. It was,
yeah.
Yes. Now significant in the world of music, Glenn Snoddy, the inventor of the fuzz pedal.
All right.
So he's a music engineer, but without him, many amazing records don't really sound the same.
Got it.
No fuzz pedal. Hey, that's a big deal. Fuzz pedal is pretty. The feedback on guitars, that's a big deal,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Alan Bean, the fourth man on the moon,
mm-hmm.
Died. So one of the original Apollo astronauts.
Yeah.
Ted Dabney, one of the co-founders of Atari. And the creator of Pong.
Right.
So hands up.
I did
up.
Read about that.
Yeah.
Yep.
We were recently in Europe at a video game museum, and I'm sure I saw a photo of him there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this does not mean anything to me, but I thought I would mention it because perhaps some of our listeners were big fans of The Office, the American show The Office, not the British show. There was a character on there named Hank, the security guard. Hugh Dane is the actor's name, and he has passed away.
I can't say I'm conversant
enough
with
the Office. He's an older black
man
that I did not recognize, but I guess if there were Office fans that are listening, I thought I would mention it because
sure.
I don't want to leave him out. I mean,
no,
that's, you know.
Fair enough.
Kent McRae, who was one of the producers of Little House on the Prairie.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a TV producer. That was sort of his thing he was best known for. Okay, now we get into perhaps some more depressing. So Kate Spade.
Yeah.
And I guess we can't really mention Kate Spade without skipping ahead a little bit in the month and talking about Anthony Bourdain as well. So
mm-hmm. It wasn't even that far ahead in the month. I mean,
no,
this,
it was like
this happened
a week
like
later.
Two. No, yeah. It was like 3 days.
Yeah. No, I just mean there's other people who passed away in
of course,
my
yeah.
list. But
yeah.
It's.
Yeah, it was a very difficult week.
It's a horrendous, horrendous thing that we're still absolutely caught in the dark about. We just do not understand this well enough to figure out how to prevent it.
No, or even if we can.
Or even if we
or
can.
Or what those conversations would be like.
Yeah.
And we don't know. I mean, not that there's necessarily a pathology you can even follow. We don't know why, air quotes, they did it. Like, what was the driving factor? You know, we'll spend a long time guessing. Yeah.
I mean, there's plenty of research into what drives people to suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so in the dark about how brains actually function.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're in the essentially the trepanning stage of figuring this out, which is
Thank you for making a trepanning reference.
Thank you. You're welcome. Yeah. You know, I was going to go with what's the one with the bumps? I was going to go with that one.
There's bumps?
There's one where you felt the bumps on people's heads. You can tell their future.
Yeah.
Whatever that one
was.
I
can't remember. Yeah.
Anyway, pseudoscience. Not pseudoscience. Yeah. Look, there's great work being done. I'm a beneficiary of some of it.
Sure.
Myself, pharmacologically, it is a good time to be around, I guess. Certainly much better than it was even 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But man, it's still like, you know, we're crushing a fly with Thor's hammer here. There's no precision to what we know.
No. That's the freaky part. And I mean, you know, spoiler for the end of the episode, we're going to probably do Bourdain for our July episode. And I want to get a little more into this then. But yeah, it's the lack of precision. It's the degree to which we are guessing most of the time.
Yeah, we are, you know.
That terrifies the shit out of me.
Yeah, you know, as much as it's a real discipline and psychiatry, psychotherapy is certainly advanced from where it started, it's still like, you know, going to see a medieval barber. Like, it's not quite there yet.
Yeah, very much so.
Okay, back to the list. So Robert Mandan, who is an actor on Soap and Benson.
Right.
Sort of a 70s icon actor, right?
Yeah,
he
man.
Passed away. Jerry Marin, the last surviving munchkin from The Wizard of Oz. The leader of the Lollipop Guild.
Well, I mean.
Way.
Yeah, no, I remember.
Represent. Jerry Marin died. He was like 98. Can you imagine being a little person and living to 98? Like, that is beating the odds.
Got
to
be a lot of work.
Guys,
yeah.
That is not a condition or a state of being that leads to long life usually. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty amazing. Speaking of long life, Clarence Fountain, the lead singer and one of the founders of the Blind Boys of Alabama, died well into his, I think, 80s or 90s. This person you may not have heard of, but I wanted to include her because we've read some of her books around my house, and she was quite a gifted writer. Jill Kerr Conway was an Australian author and quite outspoken feminist. Worked very hard within Australia to advance feminist ideals, and her books are memoirs about growing up in the outback, and they're wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Kira Muratova, who was a Soviet director that was called out.
Yeah.
Online and just one of these giant blind spots. I have never heard of her. And it was like, this is a crime that no one has heard of her.
Right. Yeah. Mark Cousins was really bigging her up and mentioning that it's really astonishing that a canon of work as significant as hers, which again, I had no familiarity with at all, had kind of just gone unseen by world cinephiles.
You can't know what you don't know. And when people don't get curated and they don't get put forward, they don't. And
then
how can, you know? So I'd call it a blind spot, except it's like it's far removed from that.
Yeah, it's a little further down the road than a blind spot.
So I did want to mention her.
Yeah.
Peter Stringfellow, who was considered to be the preeminent club owner in the 60s and 70s London club scene. So one of these guys that's in the background in a lot of photos of the Rolling Stones and stuff. there's that guy with the glasses and the long hair, right?
Gotcha.
Okay, so Anthony Bourdain. Jackson O'Dell, who's a young actor and had been in a number of, was kind of like an up-and-coming actor. I think he was only 20 when he passed away. Another editor, another female editor, besides Anne V. Coates, and that was Francois Bonneau, worked primarily with Jean-Pierre Melville and Costa Gavras.
Right.
So she edited Army of Shadows. She edited Z, which have you seen Z?
I have not yet seen Z.
Man, that is a good movie.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
This one I know close to your heart, Eunice Gayson.
Yep.
So Eunice Gayson is officially the first Bond girl.
Mm-hmm.
She played Sylvia Trench in Dr. No.
Yep.
And
she does come back in from Russia?
I don't think so, but maybe.
Maybe in the book. I can't
maybe
remember.
In the book.
I think her character comes back in the book.
Yeah, but you know, in the film, the more well-known one is Ursula Andress, of course, but the first Bond girl on screen is Eunice Gayson. A British actor, Leslie Grantham, primarily known for soaps, EastEnders, that kind of stuff. Now, this for me, this was big because I didn't actually realize this guy was still alive. DJ Fontana, Elvis's drummer.
Okay.
The drums you hear on every classic Elvis song, that's DJ Fontana.
Yeah, I am surprised that guy's
I'm
still alive.
I'm surprised he was alive. So was still one alive. Of Elvis's sort of pit crew guys that rolled with him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he passed away just very recently. David McFadden, who was a Canadian poet. I actually got appointed to this by Margaret Atwood on Twitter.
Yeah, same.
And really interesting. He had interesting. His poetry is wonderful, but also he died of this sort of very rare. It's not Alzheimer's, but it's a related malady that has to do with aphasia. Mm-hmm. So for a poet and someone who works in metaphor, to be trapped in an aphasic kind of reality is. What's the opposite of poetic justice? Like, it must have been excruciating for him to not be able to really express himself. Another, I think, notable Canadian, Stephen Reed. He was in later life an author, but he's most well known for being one of the most successful bank robbers in the history of Canada. I love this. As soon as I heard it, I was like, oh, yeah, I kind of remember this from growing up. He was in a group of three guys that were known as the Stopwatch Gang. And they were known as the Stopwatch Gang because they would wear stopwatches, and the robberies would be 2 minutes or less. Mm-hmm. So they would go in, stopwatches go, and they would be out within 2 minutes. Over 100 successful bank robberies.
Wow.
They got away with over $15 million before they were caught.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right? And all great. Because they were,
I mean,
it was about
horrible
precision.
Criminality, but it's great.
I feel like robbing a bank's the only crime I'm not even upset by.
Yeah.
The money's insured. It's like if you do it well, no one gets hurt. I'm like, take the money. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe too many movies. And then just two more. So film producer Martin Bregman.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a better example of a New York tough Jew film producer, this is the guy. he's like Ragtime and
Scarface.
Yeah. And Carlito's Way, and he worked with like Mamet and Lumet and so good. Anyway, it's he passed away at a very elderly, like I think he's about 95. And the last one, Blues Brothers fans, Matt Guitar Murphy died. So this will mean nothing to you. You don't like the Blues Brothers.
I haven't seen the Blues Brothers.
You,
I neither am for nor against.
No, you can't be on the fence.
The Blues
with this.
Brothers.
Anyway. Matt Guitar Murphy, one of the original members of Booker T and the MGs, one of the guys that really set up the sort of Stax sound in the 60s, and then was, when Paul Schaefer went shopping for the Blues Brothers band, he was high on the list, along with Blue Lou Marini and many other guys, and he's not only is he a phenomenal player, but I think he is the sort of unsung hilarious highlight of the Blues Brothers movie. His timing is very good. And for a guy that is not an actor or a comedian, he acquits himself just fine in that movie. It's a delightful performance. So,
well, yeah, maybe someday I will watch the Blues Brothers.
I highly recommend it. It's a very wonderful movie.
I mean, maybe I'm just saving it for, I'm not even going to say it.
I don't know. Occasionally they play it here.
Yeah, no, I know.
In Toronto at the TIFF.
I was going to make a very dark death-related joke, but I'm not going to do it now.
Would it be about John Landis or just in general?
Oh, Landis. I'll go with Landis.
Sure.
I'll save it for when Landis dies.
All right.
There we go.
All right.
No, I have no reason to not watch the Blues Brothers. Just, the time is finite, guys. Finite.
It is. There's a limited amount of it.
Yeah. All right. So the thank you. That was roll call, and that was excellent. So today's subject, as I mentioned at the top of the show, N.V. Coates, editor, British editor, who is, I guess, most famous because she executed one of the two most important cuts in cinema's history.
Is this now? This would not be considered a match cut. Is this?
That's very funny.
But it is. But it isn't. Right?
It is not a match cut.
It's not
in
a match
the
cut.
Actual
but it
definition
is a match
of
cut.
A match cut.
Yeah.
It is a cut of a man.
Well, it
blowing
is kind
up.
Of though, because it goes right to the sun. Like it's
no, because a match cut should be a matching action across two different versions
fair.
Of space.
So when you talk about the two most. What is your other one?
Well, I mean, I think you'd have to put the bone to the spacecraft on that list.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, for me personally, I'm more of a lean guy than a Kubrick guy anyway. So obviously, that moment.
All right.
Is
so let's
definitive.
Just, let's just get it on the table. There are very few times, and there should be very few times, that editing itself takes center stage, and that is certainly one of them, and so is the bone to the spaceship. I will throw in the shot at the end of the Great Train Robbery in 1910 or whatever.
Yeah, fair enough.
For being the first time that editing becomes the tool, right?
Yep.
So I will throw that in there.
Yeah, but no, that's fair. And I mean, there are certainly moments throughout. I mean, obviously, I'm a big fan of the Russians and the whole Eisensteinian movement. There are times when the baton of what editing could do in a story, and not just for storytelling purposes, but for thematic purposes, disruptive purposes, got moved way the hell forward. Lots of those. I'm just like, for one of those just sublime
moments. It's perfect. Yeah.
You got this cut perfect. In Lawrence of Arabia. Anyway, I'll do a quick bio. There isn't too much. There isn't very much on her Wikipedia page.
There isn't, but there was a
really don't, you know. Yeah. So go ahead.
There is a really interesting fact on there, though.
Right.
So we'll talk about
that. All right. Well, let me know if I got it.
Okay.
So she was born on the 12th of December, 1925, in Surrey, England. She worked as a nurse in plastic surgery prior to becoming an editor.
One kind of cutting to another.
Yeah. And I wanted to mention.
I love that it's plastic surgery. That is really trash.
It's interesting. One of the things, I don't know if this is true or not, this is kind of like just one of these anecdotal things I always heard over the years, is that one of the reasons that there are so many, one of the reasons there are so many women in editing or in older editing, because they seem to have sort of been weeded out of editing as
I don't think they were ever a majority, but they're certainly,
they're notable.
They hit above their weight when they're in there, right?
Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of that was because of wartime, because, you know.
Possibly,
women could do the work. But there's this kind of idea that I've always had in my head that I must have heard somewhere, which is that editing was considered more of a woman's craft because it more represented sort of, you know, needlework and sewing and kind of hands-based things that women were associated
craft.
With at the time. Yeah, craft. And I thought that was a nice connection there, too, with the idea that she was a nurse. Like, she's the director's nurse.
See, I'd say that's certainly true.
Yeah.
I always think of it more like, you know, women are editors because the editor's job, in a sense, is to be the movie's first critic. And they love to nag.
What?
They love, they like to shop.
No.
Is that, no, is
do you
that
want
not?
Me to, do you really want this on the record? Should I be marking this moment in the audio timeline? I'll continue.
Go, please.
If we're done. Funny, I've got one. Here's her saying back to us. In a way, I've never looked at myself as a woman in the business. I've just looked at myself as an editor. I mean, I'm sure I've been turned down because I'm a woman, but then other times I've been used because they wanted a woman editor.
Yes.
So she became interested in cinema after seeing Wyler's version of Wuthering Heights. That's the one with Lawrence Olivier.
When she was 14, if you do the math.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And, I mean, just pumped out a litany of classics over the course of her career. She was nominated for the Oscar 5 times, so for Lawrence of Arabia, which we've discussed, Beckett, which I have not seen or even heard of, The Elephant Man.
Oh, Beckett is wonderful.
Is that right?
It's great, yeah.
The Elephant Man, which is fucking terrific.
Yeah.
In the Line of Fire, which I guess is pretty good. I mean,
it's
well edited.
It's really well put together.
Yeah.
Maybe In the Line of Fire is not your cup of tea, but man, that's a slickly produced.
And of course, because he is, I would say possibly even more so than Martin Scorsese, he is the cinephile. Soderbergh grabs her at the tail end of the century, and she does Out of Sight and Aaron Brockovich back-to-back, or pretty much back-to-back. Now, I did one stupid thing in preparing for this show, which is I didn't actually watch the sex scene from Out of Sight over again, because it got literally, it's so good, it got mentioned in all of her obituaries that she cut that scene. Now, Soderbergh obviously, you know, pretty much after he was done working with her, began cutting his own films pretty much exclusively. So she was kind of the last editor that he worked with. So she received both the BAFTA Fellowship and the Oscar Lifetime Achievement Award for her commitment to film, and she passed away this year. So
you did not mention the interesting fact, which
will
mention,
which is that
she's the grandniece of J. Arthur Rank.
Is she?
Yes.
No, I didn't
know her
that.
Mother was a Rank in her, like that was her maiden name. And so she comes by filmmaking quite honestly.
Yeah.
And most
playing
people,
gongs.
Yeah. So, and gongs, yes. And giant muscular men. you know, Rank is like, I mean, for Britain, it's like being related to Louis B. Mayer.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, Jack Warner.
Like, absolutely.
So to me, that's interesting because it wasn't just that she liked films and went to see them, but she actually was probably in a unique position to know how to go about finding out if she could do it.
Right.
Right. So she started in the war cutting, or not really cutting, but doing assemblies probably as an assistant editor, and then graduated to editing films for Ron Neim first, who is probably most people are more familiar with Charles Crichton in terms of the movies that came out of Ealing. But mm-hmm. Ronald Neim is the one that did the ones that they're still Ealing films.
Yeah.
But they cross over more into kind of artful territory. The two that she worked on are, I consider to be the two most accomplished, not the funniest, but the most accomplished films to come out of Ealing. So The Horse's Mouth
yeah.
and Tunes of Glory.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there are funnier Ealing films for sure. You know, the Lady Killers is funnier,
mm-hmm.
but boy, there's very few films I would say that are a bigger pleasure to watch for the first time than The Horse's Mouth.
Right.
It was in the Criterion Collection probably like in the first wave.
It was. I have yet to be able to secure a copy. It went out of print a decade ago.
I've got a copy.
Yeah, of course.
So of course I did.
Yeah.
So I will happily lend it to you. But
no, it's not a question
of
borrowing. It's I want to be able to say to myself,
hey,
that
it's on my shelf.
That I own
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Fans of Alec Guinness,
yeah.
find The Horse's Mouth. It's the best Alec Guinness performance, and I'm including Star Wars in that.
I wouldn't put his Star Wars performance in the top five.
No, it's anyway.
It's fine. It's good. Fine. He's
yeah.
good at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought that was cool and also speaks to kind of there's a privilege aspect to this where she gets to do these things
right.
in a way that maybe not everyone did.
Indeed. Now, I was a dumbass and I decided to watch what is actually her last completed film on her filmography, which is
oh,
50
no.
Shades of Grey.
Oh, no.
Which we'll get to.
Oh, no.
But what did you watch?
Oh, because, I mean, mine wasn't a great movie either,
and yeah.
but not because of her work.
No,
but
no.
I was like, a movie from the 1970s
yep.
that's a political thriller
yep.
that stars Robert Duvall and Michael Caine and I'm trying to go through the whole list of people that are in this. And Donald Sutherland.
Mm-hmm.
And Donald Pleasance,
mm-hmm.
and I've never seen it.
Yeah.
Oh, sign me up. What yep. is this movie, right? And the movie is called The Eagle Has Landed.
Yep.
And I realized, I mean, I'm sure I was familiar with the title, but I, for some reason, it had slipped through, and I was like, how did this slip through? And I didn't see it, and then I watched it.
Mm-hmm. And
is it
very poor?
Well, here's the thing about it.
Yeah.
It's not even that it's very poor. It's not great. It has a very ridiculous plot. So the setup of the movie is that towards the end of World War II, when most of the Germans know that they are losing,
yep.
Hitler is at a meeting with a bunch of other fanatics like Himmler and Goering,
mm-hmm.
and someone says, and they've just rescued Mussolini. So I guess this is the true part that they base the ridiculousness on, which is that they had engaged in this daring extraction of Mussolini from a castle somewhere.
Sure. All right.
And it had gone well. They got Mussolini from away from us, the good guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So and may I mention, movie is from the point of view of the Nazis. It's they are the good guys in this movie.
Oh.
It's one of those. So let's start there. And
was it written by the New York Times?
Yeah.
Oh,
Barry Weiss.
Yeah.
So it's a, you know, it's like the Holocaust is happening elsewhere
of
while
course.
This movie goes on.
How
this
convenient.
Is more about the tactics and bureaucracy.
Indeed.
So anyway, somebody goes, well, if we can get Mussolini out, why don't we kidnap and kill Winston Churchill? So that is the plot.
Oh.
So at first it is, why don't we write up a paper that shows just how ridiculous this is so we won't do it?
Mm-hmm.
So they get Robert Duvall, who I swear to God has a wooden hand and an eye patch.
Awesome.
And,
awesome.
And may I mention, this is a movie where everyone has been cast to do the wrong accent. So Robert Duvall is doing a German accent.
Great.
That is tasty. It hangs in the air. And Donald Sutherland is an Irish with a thick Irish brogue
yep.
professor who is teaching at a university in Berlin because he's against the Allies because of the troubles in Ireland. So
mm-hmm.
it's the my enemy of my enemy is my friend thing.
Yep.
He's aligned with the Germans because he wants to defeat Churchill and the Britons so that Ireland can be can throw off the yoke of the British. So he's in. to help the, so they're, so they, anyway, they get Duvall, and his superior, somebody goes, look, do a feasibility study just so you can show how stupid this is. Mm-hmm. And then, in doing the feasibility study, he goes, you know, this might work.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and the story is that Churchill is going to be vacationing by the seaside, mm-hmm. in this little town where they can get a U-boat off the coast and infiltrate and pretend to be. And here's how they're going to do it. They're going to get high profile, very, very skilled paratroopers led by Michael Caine, also doing a German accent for no reason. Like, everyone has the wrong accent. Great. In this movie. Michael Caine is going to lead these guys in, and they're going to pretend to be Poles who have escaped Poland and are now fighting for the Allies, because I guess that was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
There were Polish groups, Polish troop, what's the word I'm looking for?
No idea.
Deployments, whatever.
Sure.
Platoons.
Okay,
that's the word.
Platoons.
I'm platoons. There were Polish platoons.
Yep.
And so they can all, these Germans can all speak Polish passably, so they're going to pose as Poles and go and say that they're on exercises in the British town, all the while just waiting, laying in wait for Churchill to show up. So there's that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's not a great movie.
So this all sounds wonderful.
It does.
But the question to you is this.
Yes.
Is it well edited?
It is well edited. So here's what's crazy about it, yeah. is that in the midst of all this ridiculousness, and I haven't even scratched the surface, mm-hmm. it's a very ridiculous movie. But man, it really moves.
Oh,
like,
man.
I noticed right away, oh, this thing's snappy.
Uh-huh.
You know? So I do think, like, among the things that I think she was great at, and that I think is valuable for an editor, is to understand how to pace out a movie.
Sure.
And to understand that it's different. So you could charitably say that the Lawrence of Arabia is paced methodically at certain points,
yep.
like quite methodically, in a way that is utterly captivating.
Mm-hmm.
And where it needs to be, you know, pick up the slack of a story that perhaps is not carrying itself, she's right there saying, well, if we go a little faster, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
You know? And yep. so, yeah, it's, I mean, in as much as I think she's not an editor that normally, and I should say this is a bad thing, but that normally calls attention to the edits, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, she, you know, it's just telling the story in an economical way.
Well, as you said, like when we mentioned the cut, you know, really in the original idea of editing, or the classic Hollywood idea of editing, you're not supposed to see it, you're not supposed to feel it, you're not supposed to understand it. You're just, I think what Murch said is it's like literally the camera has to, the shot has to blink at the exact moment you'd blink.
Exactly.
Right? Like, it just has to be like part of your bodily process.
Yeah.
And I think there's a very, that makes a craftsperson like Ms. Coates very difficult to analyze, because really, if she's done her job successfully, the movie works and you're not noticing it.
If you're feeling intent at all, you're feeling directorial intent.
Yeah.
And like I said, and I did mean, you know, as much as I made a joke about it, it is their job to be the film's first critic.
Yeah.
And to say, well, here's what's not working, so we can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the editing that I think that she is contributing, is the ability to have, you can even see it in some of these later quotes about working with Soderbergh, that what she likes is that you get in there and you actually fight.
Right.
In a way, for what is important about mm-hmm. the film and how it's important to say it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And so I, you know, again, like a.
So 50 Shades of Grey.
Like a dumbass. I
can't believe you passed up Beckett.
Well, I didn't know about Beckett.
No,
I didn't know anything about it. And
yeah.
I mean, like, I like Sam Taylor Johnson quite a bit. I liked her short film. I liked her first feature film. I like her husband that took her last name. I think the whole thing's very sweet. So I'm like, I'm going to see what this is like. What I didn't know, because I didn't actually bother to go to the 50 Shades of Grey page on the IMDb, is that Ann Coates is not the only editor on that project. There were three. Don't know which parts of the film she worked on versus other people. And I mean, look, motherfucking movie is 128 minutes long, and the actual best thing in it happens at minute 7. Now, I am not saying that the movie feels like it is paced incorrectly or that it is not the length it is supposed to be, but it's a very, like, almost indescribably bad piece of writing. Like, it is an incredibly poor story.
It is unbelievable that the phenomenon of these books.
In one level, I mean, God bless the thing, because it is so rare that people who don't spend their nights trolling fan fiction on the internet get to see what is essentially unalloyed sexual fantasy rendered large.
Yeah.
Right? Like, this is not even attempting to disguise its roots as a sex story that someone wrote about, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Twilight?
Yes, it
and
started
took
off as
the vampires
Twilight fan fiction that they then, it got so popular, they were like, well, if we just turn them back into businessmen,
we
can make this work. Yeah, it started off as the main character is supposed to be Edward, I think.
Yeah. No, oh, is that right? Okay, so that
means, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll lay my cards on the table, maybe more information than anyone needs. I've never been a BDSM guy. I don't really get it. I've never.
How is that laying something on the table? Tell us what you are, not what you aren't.
Right. I didn't want to pull away a tantalizing idea.
I'll lay a card on the table.
Yeah. No. Yeah. You want to see a fucking card? Here's a card. It's called a horsey butt plug, and it's very large.
Knight of balls.
Yeah. Yeah. but yeah, like, I mean, On some of the strength of the writing that came out when the film came out, I also don't. It seems that this film is not particularly. It seems like a mainstreaming of a very complex.
Here's
idea.
What I'm fascinated by, though.
Yep.
The idea that Anne V. Coates, who doesn't have to work, would take this, especially at the advanced age she was at.
Yep.
And go like, "Yep, I'm interested in this."
Sure.
That's amazing. Well, even if it turned out to be like not a good
absolutely.
Movie. I respect, like, hey, here's an 80-year-old woman that would like to be involved in this project.
Yeah.
You know, that's great.
Yeah. You know what other fucking movie she made that I can't stand? The Golden Compass, which, ironically, is another film that, I mean, I don't know who had Final Cut or what level of control.
Yeah, I'm not going to blame her for the way the story goes.
No, but I would say that is a very poorly edited film. That film is clearly not the length that it is trying to be, that it was shot to be, and it's been horribly condensed by a studio that's trying to make changes.
Yeah, so it's really hard to judge how she was involved in it.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say one more thing about 50 Shades, which is that this all would have been uncomfortable post John Gomeshi, which I believe it was when the film was released.
Yes.
Post Me Too, it is goddamn vile. It is,
everything is
theoretically consensual within the framework of the story. However, it also is not. You know, it is a relationship.
I have not seen it, and it's such a gray area.
Yeah,
for real, to wade into.
There you go.
Because
you see a lot of Grey's area.
I understand.
Yeah.
Do you see Grey's Anatomy?
The word backball gets used a lot in podcasts.
Gets thrown around a lot these days. Really? Hanging?
Yeah.
Pendulous?
Oh my goodness! So. Yeah.
That's not good.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, I just look. There's. Once you get into the realm of, hey, guys, this is a fantasy with a capital F, we don't mean this to be a literal depiction of anything, then I think you're in big trouble trying to parse it out.
No, absolutely. And I mean, that's one thing that I've always, you know, been interested in.
We ought to have the freedom to act in a way that is unacceptable in a fantasy.
So far beyond this instance, I've had this interest in that exact thing, where it's like, if something is a fantasy and you can articulate it however the hell you want, it shouldn't be drawn back into what does this mean, what is this like. I just mean that because it is also an acted drama that I watched on a television screen starring humans.
Yeah. There's an ooh factor.
There are lines and behaviors ways that he manipulates her that are incredibly uncomfortable to watch, even if you fully accept that it's a fantasy.
Yeah.
But then I'm also interested in the fact that it is a fantasy, that if you can contextualize it within a safe space, you could be aroused by this, be interested in it, find it an interesting read.
And that we know for a fact of we know that there is a somewhat large group of women for whom this is a fantasy that they share.
Yep.
Because this thing has a broad audience.
Well, that's what I mean.
And the books had an even broader audience, and they're worse.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, it is interesting to me that fantasies of this type that deal, obviously, in power dynamics and the surrender of power obviously come from a very real place. Like I said, this is like mainlining that fantasy. Like, there's not even an attempt to dress it up in any more artful terms than it was probably on the page. So that's fascinating. But it is difficult as a male to sit and watch. I mean, I'm sure not just as a male to sit and watch this thing in the month we're in right now and be like, wow, that's.
Yeah.
Oh, I hope everyone understands. I mean, you're always like, does everyone get this is a fantasy? Does everyone understand that what you're watching is science fiction? Because if Star Wars isn't any indication, oftentimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that kind of thing just, pushed a lot of buttons.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry.
No, it's fine.
This is no way to celebrate.
No, it's wow. I mean, I not as often as some people, but I do love watching a really bad movie because it is fascinating. And the number of times, like, I just literally shouted, "What is happening?" during this movie, it was quite entertaining. Honestly, it really was. And I mean, my heart goes out.
Just snorted.
Yeah, my heart goes out to Dakota Johnson, who I think is probably a pretty good actress. And I think
God bless them. They're all game.
I think Jamie Dornan is a serial killer in real life.
Yeah, he's certainly convincing. Right?
I can't quite get. I mean, he's so good in The Fall that I can't actually get it out of my head.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I know. He is so scary, sort of dead inside that I watch every week and can't figure out, like, why hasn't he popped up on Handmaid's Tale?
Yeah.
He's that dead. I keep expecting him to come around the corner as, like, one of the guards.
Yeah.
You know?
And there are moments, if I'm not misremembering, he was up at some point for Superman. And there are moments in this movie where you look at him and you're like, yeah, you really look like Superman, except for the thing where there's nothing inside
you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right.
Where your eyes are black circles.
Where you are, your face is the abyss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. All right. Well, I think that concludes our discussion of the works of legendary film editor N.V. Coates.
Guys, let's be clear.
Yeah.
Maybe we should say this because we haven't said it in a while, but one of the tasks for us is to watch films by these people that we haven't seen.
As much as possible,
That's the idea of let's explore a corner. The problem with someone as great and wonderful as N.V. Coates is we have seen many of the great ones. Please don't watch the ones we watched.
Yeah.
That's our job.
No, absolutely. So I was going to say,
watch Lawrence of Arabia if you've never seen it. Man, watch Tunes of Glory if you've never seen it. Yep. It's fantastic. You know, watch Beckett, which is the greatest.
If you want to watch a, quote, bad movie edited by N.V. Coates, watch Masters of the Universe.
Oh, that's a wonderful movie. Wonderful. That is an exceptionally funny, wonderful movie.
I love Masters of the Universe. I have a lot of affection for that film.
I just recently rewatched Willow, which has kind of been coming up a lot
because we're on Howard and Solo and so forth.
And you think, man, Billy Barty in Willow, that's about the best Billy Barty. Oh, no, it's not a patch on Masters of the Universe.
Yeah.
That's the real Billy Barty. He is a fucking riot
Man.
In that movie. It's great.
Yeah. Even Dolph is very good.
He's terrific.
In Masters of the Universe.
Yeah.
And I've never said that sentence out loud before.
Yeah.
I've never started a sentence with even Dolph. Anyway, so what I was going to say
sounds like a Pearl Jam lyric.
We, as you may or may not know, we have a Letterboxd account for this show. If you follow us on Letterboxd, we do post a list every month of a broader selection.
Please go to that
just
list.
The crap that we
check
watched.
That out.
So yeah, there's 10 N.V. Coates films that you can look at there. And otherwise. So I think, hopefully we're not jinxing ourselves into the Stone Age, but we're going to try to do Anthony Bourdain for July.
Yeah.
Because I have almost no familiarity with his work other than watching the Bradley Cooper show on Fox.
Of Kitchen Confidential.
Of Kitchen Confidential, the book of which I have not read. So my work's cut out for me. I want to get to know this guy better based on everything that was
and on
said
the just amazing outpouring of reaction.
Yeah, exactly. That's what made me want to do it.
You know, few people get that sort of cultural moment that he deservedly got.
Yeah, and I mean,
but we'll talk about it more.
Yeah, and because as you said, we are trying to broaden our own base of things that we've watched. Having someone where I have no familiarity is actually quite exciting because I can kind of go in any different number of directions with it.
Yeah.
So thank you all very much for listening. You can follow us on both Twitter or Letterboxd at DeathWatchPod. Shows are at ModernSuperior.com. Feel free to check out all the other programs also at ModernSuperior.com. And we'll see you guys in July.
We're on iTunes. Give us a review.
Yeah, throw in a review on iTunes. Or does the Play Store do reviews? Probably.
Reviews
are everything these days. Fuck you, Google.
Fucking
we'll
Google.
We'll see you on Death Watch, Google.
Don't give Google any more information than it already has. Put it on iTunes.
Yeah, because Apple is like much more beneficent with the data collection. Look, we're all boned.
Hey,
okay?
Man.
We're boned.
You want to have this? You want to go down this road?
Let me tell you something. The one thing you don't want to... What's it called? The new policy in Europe, GDPR or something like that? So you do not want to be traveling in Europe... The week they roll that shit out.
Oh, that must have been fun.
You can't do anything.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't even look at your phone.
Everyone is scared.
Oh, man. Scared. It was wild. Thanks all so much for listening.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.